17 minutes after 7 o'clock. We do have Afro Raymond in the studio.
All right, so we're here with property expert Afro Raymond. I know that you're not professional, like you're a land surveyor, yeah?
Valuator.
Chartered valuation.
So good morning. Are we on here?
Yeah.
Yes, we are on.
Red light on? Yes, we're on.
Made the transition without me being universal and fidgety.
You see, look at her. I didn't, because you get on a custom now.
Interviewers, a good morning to listeners. So thank you for having me on the
No
radio.
Problem, Pat. Morning.
You are listening to Power 102.
So we're here to discuss something that is very, very, very important. And one of the reasons I wanted you here was is essentially because you were the first person to draw it to the public's attention in your column.
Yeah.
Dr. Rowley would have raised it briefly in his response to the budget in the 2013 budget in October 2012, but you had really gone into it in quite some detail.
That's right.
January 2013, I don't remember the specific date, but I know you probably do, in the article titled From THA Bolt to Calcutta. And that was the first time that I remembered seeing Eden Gardens in a story. And you talking about, then you talked about the whole business of the stamp duty being a problem. So I don't know if you want to run us through the background to the to Eden Gardens then, and then we come forward to what is happening now.
This is Power 102.
Well, the Eden Gardens matter is a complex fraud. And the characteristics of a complex fraud are that, in fact, a number of well-qualified well-placed persons in positions of responsibility, they collaborate secretly, of course, to extract a fraud on some unsuspecting stakeholders. In this case, the stakeholder who was unsuspecting, who was defrauded, is a taxpayer. So you have a situation where a number of people in positions of responsibility nudge, they wink, they look the other way, they pass things to each other under the table, and they meet in the dead of night. Sometimes they meet in boardrooms in broad daylight. And what they do is that they've constructed a complex fraud, and they distinguish it. There are two really important distinguishing features of complex frauds. The first one is that it's a question of size. It's what those of us in anti-corruption work would call, what we would call grand corruption. So it's not a case of somebody at license and office taking a little money for such and such, or somebody at a regional corporation taking a little money for so and so. This is actually, these cases run into 50s and hundreds of millions of dollars. In this case, the state paid 5 times more than they needed to pay for that land. They could have purchased all that land lawfully for 35 million TT dollars, but ended up paying 175 million. I demonstrated that in the articles. So the first feature of the complex fraud is its sheer size. And the second feature of the complex fraud is that conventional systems of law enforcement, professional enforcement, and reporting are not responsive to complex frauds, because all the parties who could make a report were in on it.
Well, with hundreds of millions of dollars, everybody collecting a rate.
Yeah, so basically, no report is made. Therefore, we need to be mindful as we go forward that the society needs to develop systems, and not just the society like the police and the courts and so, but the society, including the professional societies, need to develop systems that are alert to and responsive to the changing winds of the media when credible reports become available, and to consider that to be a report.
If you don't mind me kind of shifting it up
of course.
A little bit to ask you what kinds of systems you're referring to then, I want to swing back to Eden Gardens.
Okay, sure. For example, a lot of the systems we have in the country don't, for example, the Law Association, just to give an example, this thing would not have been possible without the collaboration of certain lawyers. The Law Association, for instance, I spoke with people there. The names of the people is not important, but I spoke with the chief people there at the time. The head of complaints and the president of the Law Association, as the person then was, the head of disciplinary board, you know, and the both of them said to me, well, we haven't had a report. Although I'd written all the details in the press, we haven't had a report. And I said to them, something's wrong with that fundamentally. Are you telling me that if two policemen are standing there and see somebody attacking an old lady across the street, do the policemen need to wait for a report before they cross the street and do the correct thing?
Explain.
And if you are an alert, vigilant professional association and you see something taking place that involves major fraud and you have it explained in detail, not in personal terms, isn't it incumbent on you to take action? But in fact,
in what capacity would the law association have to come in there though?
I'm curious. Disciplinary.
Okay, disciplinary. Who would they be disciplining?
The attorneys involved in this.
Okay.
Yeah. My complaint, my letters, my articles make that very clear. Yeah. And I was aghast. And in fact, I was directed. There's a particular part, I forget the section in the Legal Profession Act. There's a particular section in there that defines who can make a complaint. Yeah. And in fact, it's really somebody who's a client or somebody who's injured. And it goes back to the Reginald Dumas principle. When Reginald Dumas won the case of the Privy Council about the police, you know, the Police Service Commission,
yes,
with Dr.
Yes,
Armstrong and
yes,
others.
Yes.
And the point that the Privy Council upheld, that our appeal court had first put in place, is that somebody can bring a motion to test the impropriety of an action or whether an action conforms to the law, even if the person is just a mere citizen. Mm-hmm. The person doesn't have to prove that I was injured, or I lost this land, or I lost a job. But the position of the law association, the way they think is their laws are crafted, and it's very much in line with a lot of other thinking in the legal system, the way their laws are crafted, an injured party has to make a report. And I am saying that it's wrong, that it's inappropriate for complex frauds. It doesn't work. And I had to insist that at a tremendous level for us to get to this point. And I'm glad that we got here. So the persons who took the correct action, the first powers that be, thank you. And let us hope that this could come to a proper conclusion.
Right.
But Afra, just to go back a bit.
Sure.
The issue of overpricing, underpricing, that's not new. Because these valuators and assessors have been powerful people in the past, where they will overvalue a property for the sake of you getting top dollar, or they will undervalue it for the sake of you saving tax dollars. That's also, this is nothing, what happened, what appears to have happened. And I don't know that we want to talk about that directly. We're talking about incidents like this.
So what are you asking me to comment on, if you don't mind? What's the question? Because I mean, I'm a evaluator, so I have to be careful.
Right.
But go on.
Right, but I know you're a long-standing evaluator with
so
a
reputation. So your concern is that, in fact, there's a flexibility in terms of what the answers could be?
Is it? Because I'll tell you something. Mm. Because I sat in a capacity where we were told that it's my prerogative. It's entirely subjected to me.
This is Power 102, empowering you.
No, it's not entirely subjected. That's not true. I mean, I want to answer you. I hear you, Wendy. I want to answer you. I want to give two rejoinders to you. First of all, on a general point, and I'd come to Eden Garden. Secondly, on a general point, it's not entirely subjective. Yes, there's a degree of what we don't use the word subjective, we call it professional judgment. And in fact, if you go to any professional, whether it's a medical issue, it could be a legal issue, it could be something with your car engine is making a funny noise. If you go to any trained person, three or four of them, they would give you different opinions. Unless it's something dead simple, the car has a flat tire. They would give you different opinions with the same set of facts. So there's nothing disreputable about having a range of opinions on a particular question. The whole thing ought to be based, in the case of a violation like Eden Gardens, it ought to be based on the evidence in the area, the comparable evidence in the area. And that is really one of the difficulties in this case. You see, so the first thing I want to say is that it's not subjective. There's a bedrock of objective, comparable evidence, and you apply your professional judgment to whether this is exactly the same as the property, or it's 25% better, or this comparable is not as good, because the area is not as good, so you adjust it slightly to get the correct figure for what it is you're doing. In the case of Eden Gardens, what was remarkable, because the question you were saying on is a question about the variety of valuation opinions, is that most people listening to this show, most people in the profession, I hope some of us are listening this morning, know that if you have a property in a given location here, and you get a private valuation, you get what we call colloquially a government valuation. The government valuation is always lower. Is it not that not so?
Yes.
Everybody knows that. Except
no, that can't be the case.
Except in Eden Gardens,
that, where the private violation, that can't be the case.
The private violation was $52 million,
right?
And the government violation was $180 million. At that point, you have to start scratching your head,
right? Well, I agree with that. It must raise a flag immediately that a reputable valuator like Lyndon Scott would have valued it at a certain amount, and all of a sudden, a government valuator saying it's 3 times the amount. Yeah. That must raise concern.
He valued it at a little over 50 million.
52.
Yeah, 52 million TT dollars. And then the eventual price that was paid for it was 175. Now, before we get to that final figure on what may or may not have happened where that final figure is concerned, the property seemed to have changed hands a number of times, back and forth between the original owner and the persons that would have become Point Lisa's parks. Right, from between 2004 to 2010, there seemed to be a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. Is that normal?
Well, that kind of to-ing and fro-ing will happen in certain situations. I think the people were trying to do the development at the beginning on their own. In other words, I think it was 4 or 5 businessmen together trying to do a development of a piece of land that belonged to one of the businessmen. And at some point, they would have had advice that it was better to put the whole thing into a company name, which is often the way business of a certain size is conducted. True. So all of the buildings in Port of Spain of a certain size are in company names. Very seldom you find a building in a human being's name.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So they put the land into a company name, and then they did a particular financial arrangement in February of 2010, where in fact they purchased the property, the company, from one of the fellas for a stated price of $5 million, and the guy on that day gave them back a mortgage of $18.5 million, which is kind of amusing because it was February 3rd of 2010. There were 3 deeds on that day. What's amusing about it is that you're telling, on the one hand, you're telling the Registrar General over here that I just purchased this property for $5 million from that person. And on the same day, you have a deed telling the Registrar General and that person gave me a mortgage for $18.5 million for this property.
That's one of the things I wanted you to clear up for me.
So that is literally, and I mean it in the literal meaning of the word, that's literally incredible. It's literally impossible. Because, in fact, a mortgage is a fraction of, in other words, what I mean is less than 100% of the value of a property. Okay? Therefore, if the property could be mortgaged for $18.5 million, the property is a security. The property must be worth more than $18.5 million, which means that the deed for $5 million was constructed. What do you call it? A kind of a contraption.
Okay? For the purposes of taxes. No.
Pay less stamp
duty. No, but right. So this is a question I wanted to ask. Because in looking at the documents, I was trying to figure out how is it on February the 3rd, 2010, you could sell the property for $5 million and then have the property be mortgaged for $18.5 million.
Yeah. And it's not just the mortgage itself. The existence of the instrument is one thing, and the both instruments being signed on the same day, that's one thing. The other thing that's interesting, because I also conducted an interest rate analysis, and the interest rate on the mortgage is 8.5%. And in fact, if you go back to that period, I went back and I did the research and spoke with bankers and so on. For a project like that, borrowing that quantity of money, because in the end, I think they ended up spending $29 million putting infrastructure on the land, to borrow a sum of money about $20 million to do a land development at that period in time, because interest rates change, the commercial rate would have been between 10.5% and 12%. Therefore, the inference one can make, the reasonable inference one can make from that interest rate analysis is that 8.5% indicates a great degree of trust or a high degree of collaboration. Everybody was dancing to the same song.
It's not just the instrument, it's the interest rate.
Yeah,
right.
Yes.
So at that point in time, who would have been collaborating? Because the HDC had not yet gotten involved then.
Well, not on your paper record.
Well, yeah, no, see, you're assuming that they were not involved.
I mean, we don't know.
Well, I go.
They may have known what was coming.
Okay, because I know the paper records, and up to that point in time.
No, I think you're correct. Because what happened subsequently in 2011 was that the property was in fact offered for sale with 2 agents.
I think there was Golden Key,
and there was one called Samco. I have one of them on my website, afroraymond.net. The advertisement and the lots were actually on sale for $400,000 a lot, And what is remarkable and painful about this complex fraud, I will call it that again. What is remarkable and painful about this complex fraud is that in fact we ended up paying $664,000 a lot in 2012.
That's what HCC paid?
Yes, for land that in 2011, the very owners had an asking price of $400. If your asking price is $400, it means your property would accept $395.
Right.
Are you making sense?
Well, yeah. Good. Well, you might accept $350.
Right, but less than $400.
Right.
We are on the same
line. Right.
Good. So we have to get into the nitty-gritty of just how much this complex fraud represents. A case of robbery with a jacket and tie. It's all dressed up and it's looking nice and so on.
Minnesota would have been removed for that. If you're walking the president with somebody like that, trust me, you're safe.
No, but when that is different. Don't you understand that? It's different.
This is Power 102.
So then, okay, I'm glad you talk about being all nicely dressed up in jacket and tie and being able to make it on the list. Then HDC becomes involved.
Yes.
What is HDC's responsibility in a situation like this? If people with land, developers with land, then approach the HDC with a property?
Well, there's two things to talk about here. Just take it in two layers.
Sure.
The first layer is that HDC's responsibility according to its act, because the HDC is what we call a statutory agency. It's not a state enterprise. It's a registered company, all the shares of which happen to be owned by Minister of Finance. It's a statutory corporation. HDC is mandated by its statute to build affordable housing for low and middle income. Therefore, we need to put our minds and our hearts firmly on what is the purpose of the organization. So the question has to be, and this is where we have to proceed orderly now, was this project in accordance with its legally bound responsibilities? That's the first question.
Yeah.
And in my view, it wasn't. And I'll tell you why. Let's walk through it. If indeed and mathematically we could show each lot cost $663,850, if we could show that, the rule of thumb in our country, and this is not just any profession, any country, if you have land, Steve, and your land is worth $500,000, and you inherited that land and you got a $500,000 parcel, and you're trying to decide whether to, in a good area, whether to build or whether to sell, the general advice from the community bank managers, your friends who are contractors, your family who build already and so on, is you mustn't build on this land unless what you're putting down at least two times the amount of money.
Right.
So whatever you're putting down, there's a cost at least $1 million for you to get the full value in the area and so on. Therefore, we're talking about a house that would cost 1.3.
Yes.
Are you going along with me?
Yes, yes, yes.
And if you're going along with the house that costs 1.3, that's what you're paying the contractor and the engineer and the architect, right? Because you have the land already cost $663,850. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a house with a completed cost of $2 million. And I'm asking the question, how does that conform
to
HDC's statutory requirement to build affordable homes for low and middle income people? And my submission is that it does not. And that's where I leave that.
And you
so
know,
that's the first thing before we get into who devaluation and all of that, as a proposal, it's not standing up on all fours.
And you know that what you just described there, Afra, was stated so many times on the political platforms that AGC, they are building homes that they cannot realistically subsidize.
Yeah.
We heard that up to the other day. We heard it again.
I know.
You understand? From Minister Randall Mitchell.
Sure. I think Mitchell's recent statement, if I just take the opportunity here to say, I hope he's listening, I think Mitchell's recent statement was very refreshing. I think it was necessary. He was emphasizing that they want to return to affordable housing. A focus on affordable housing. He's the first housing minister I heard saying that. He wanted to return to a focus on rented housing. He's the first housing minister I've heard saying that. We need 22 years and back in this country. And Minister Mitchell, if that is your genuine intention, you have my support. And thank you. There's other things to fix in HDC. But thank you. We need to return to rented housing. We need to return to affordable housing.
Yeah.
So that's all I will say about Mitchell at this point in time.
Right.
So coming back to the
HDC's responsibility.
Right. So the first thing was the whole question of strategically of how does the exercise in outline conform to the purpose of the corporation. I don't think it does. The second thing is, if you receive a proposal for a piece of land that's been offered to you? Because the land at the stage it was offered to the HDC would have been offered with infrastructure and with planning permission and these sorts of things and so on. This is my understanding. And there's a very interesting wrinkle. If it was in a science fiction movie, you'd call it a warp in the space-time continuum. But in November 2011, my colleague, Lyndon Scott, and Lyndon is a respected colleague, he trained at Raymond Ampere, I know him quite well, and so Lyndon did a valuation of the property, which has become public.
Right.
So in November of 2011, he did a valuation for the HDC, the answer to which is $52 million for Eden Gardens. In January of 2012, HDC was offered the property for $200 million, at which point they went to the Commission of Valuations, and we ended up getting that deed was signed and registered and so on in November of 2012. But here's my question. Why did HDC in October or November of 2011 ask Lyndon Scott to do a valuation? What were they responding to? And I am saying that that letter of offer, which appears to have either been suppressed or disappeared from the file, that letter of offer, I'm not interested in the January 2012 one, the letter of offer that activated the request, which led to the November 2011 report, where is that letter? What was the first offer that Point Lisa Spark Limited was the first price they were prepared to offer?
So not the $200 million
price. That was in January of 2011.
Right,
yeah.
So the 2011 offer.
And there must have been an offer because the HEC wouldn't just take up $40,000 to $50,000 in professional fees.
Yeah, to ask for
valuations of a known place. There have to be a reason. Something has to have come onto their desk to say, okay, this looks interesting. Let's get a valuation.
Right.
And I want to know what was that came on their desk.
Hmm.
So that's a little, hopefully that would...
That will come out
in
the case.
Yeah, it'll come out.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Yeah, because the company would have had to say, I have this land and this is how much I want for it.
Yeah.
So AGC, okay, I need to find out how much your land worth. Let's get a valuation done by Lyndon Scott.
Yeah. So those are some of the things. The valuation from the government is normally lower. This time it was higher.
The lack of
conformity to the AGC's statutory purpose is not a choice. It's a statutory purpose. If you want to change the purpose, change the statute. It's very simple. I'm not that advancing it.
Well, that's where the whole business of fiduciary duties come into
absolutely,
play.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? This is your responsibility. You're meant to be looking after the interests of the state. Mm. You're meant to be putting the state's interests before your own. And it appears to me that between 2011 and 2012, that changed up.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the board of the HDC, but you also have, and for me, most importantly, public servants that the board would have to interact with.
Well, again, this is where there's a wrinkle. In my view, there's a curious kind of motion here. Because let's go back into that wrinkle between Lyndon Scott in November 2011 and the Commission of Valuations report in about, I think it was April of 2012. And within that wrinkle, let's suppose you're a statutory corporation, WASA, HEC, doesn't matter which one, and somebody offers you some land for something you want, and you get a valuation from private valuator A that says the land is worth $50 million, and the person is insisting on a higher price. Why go to the government valuator? Why go there? Why not get a second
private valuator?
Mm-hmm. Why didn't the person who is making the offer to the state agency provide their own valuation? You see, these are all very succulent questions. Mm-hmm. If you are so big that you have a $200 million property, you can't touch a $50,000 valuation and tell me, listen, so and so said it's worth $50,000. So there's a lot of mystery.
You know, something else there. That more than likely, when that person made that ask for that price from AGC, that they would have had it accompanied with a valuation too.
I don't know about that. I don't think that's what happened. That's not my information.
Before you get into what's your information, let's take
all right,
a break.
All right, I got a quick break, Afro. We'll be right back. It is 41 after 7.
Weekdays from 4 to 6 p.m. on Radio You Can Watch. We enter the ring. The battle is on.
No one should be encouraged to remain in such a backward mental position, and they should reject anybody who tried to keep them there.
Your views are taken to task. Your opinions are the most worthy.
I sat here quiet from 4 o'clock, and I leave you to
no,
talk.
No, come on, Thomas.
Let me talk now.
Let's get ready to rumble the issues.
What will Skippy say next?
If you are being oppressed or pushed back in an unfavorable way by this dictatorial junta, I told the people, take to the streets.
Hear it all with Barrington Skippy Thomas and Richard Norrie as they battle it out from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday on Radio You Can Watch. Power 102, empowering you.
Rishi, where's that pump you further by?
Clayton, you like this new CNG Maxi for the spin to Arima and back two times on one tank?
How much you fill up?
Boy, CNG's $1 a liter, $40 to fill the tank.
For all that distance? It'll cost me more than twice that using diesel.
Boy, my wallet real full these days.
I go out to call you Rishi Rich, yes?
CNG, less dollars, more sense. Find out more at cng.co.tt.
Are you fed up of car problems? Well, your solution is Champflair Auto Services. They repair all vehicles, makes and models, even roll-on and roll-off vehicles. Champflair Auto Services is your one-stop shop for batteries, tires, alignment, tune-up, suspension, electrical, and diagnostic scans. Wrecker services, and we'll even pick up and drop off your vehicle. So don't waste precious time going elsewhere. Let Champflair Auto Services handle it all. Give them a call at 662-6545. Champflair Auto Services, opposite Carib Brewery on the Eastern Main Road. Your total car care stop.
Fireball.
Finally, we're coming to San Fernando with the best choice in comedy for 2017.
So far?
It's Choose Your Partner Wisely. An adaptation of the popular movie, Why Did I Get Married? It's Choose Your Partner Wisely at the Southern Academy for the Performing Arts for two final performances, Saturday 15th and Sunday 16th July.
Tickets are available at the usual outlets.
Sold Out Show says everybody's talking about Choose Your Partner Wisely. So get your tickets early. They're going like hot bake with butter. And cheese. The Supper Box Office opens from Monday, 10th July, from 12 noon to 6 p.m. daily.
Do you know that in the Republic of Rarotonga, a man has the legal and moral right to have sex with his wife whenever and however he wants?
What? Yes! It's Choose Your Partner Wisely at Supper for two final performances only, Saturday 15th and Sunday 16th July. The Jukon Comedy Fest continues.
See press and Facebook for details.
Fireball.
Let's get down to business. The Business Corner is on Mondays from 2 p.m. on Power 102. 30 minutes of news, analysis, and discussions about finance, entrepreneurship, and work in the Business Corner. And for those with ideas for startup, solid tips and advice about the way forward and building a brand. From companies and currencies to investments and the role of information technology. The Business Corner with communications and business consultant Sandrine Rattan. Mondays at 2 p.m. on Power 102, empowering you in association with the Kariri Business Hatchery and First Citizens. We put you first.
So, how would you do you if you got paid to spend?
I feel I could just spin the globe, pick a place and go, yes?
Ooh, I'm on the next flight to Miami for a shopping spree. I get some clothes, shoes.
Sign up for your First Citizens Visa Platinum credit card and get up to 10,500 free bonus points for doing the things you love. Offer ends June 30th, so sign up today. First Citizens, we put you first.
For startups, entrepreneurs, and small businesses, ready to grow your business? Then the Kariri Business Hatchery is the program for you. Learn how to target the right market, manage your finances, and develop winning business pitches, and get weekly one-on-one coaching. Call us, 299-0209, extension 2661. That's 299-0209, extension 2661. Find us on Facebook, Kariri Business Incubator, or visit www.cedcariri.com.
The discussion is on every Wednesday on Power 102. Facing the issues.
What makes, emboldens a manufacturer to take this route?
Facing the issues with journalist Tony Frazier from 2 p.m. Facing the issues.
There was political initiative for people outside there to get involved in something.
This is what's happening. These are the issues on people's minds. And here is where we face them.
Are we making use of those opportunities to export into and import out of those countries?
Facing the issues with Tony Frazier. Wednesdays from 2 p.m. on Power 102, empowering you.
All right, 46 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock. Thanks for being locked on. Here's the top of the hour. All courtesy, Chamflay Auto Services. Our guest, Afro Raymond.
Evaluation surveyor, right?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, Afro, I want to ask this. Let's say I own a parcel of land in central Trinidad, and I want to offer it to the HDC for property development. What ought to happen?
Well, the kind of thing you would do, you'd write a letter to ask them whether they'd be interested. And that sort of letter like that would be accompanied by a basic document, like a plan to show where the land is, and an outline of what price you're asking, and so on. And if you have planning permission, those are the sorts of things. So if you put any infrastructure in, those are the sorts of things that would be included in a preliminary letter. Later on, you may want to get, if they are interested, there would be more detailed documents required. So they may want to see the deed for the property and this and that and so on. And that is all moving towards them getting a valuation, because a valuation surveyor would need to have those things to do the valuation. But of course, it raises the question, going back to the HDC and its purpose and how it operates, how it ought to operate properly. It goes back to the question of why buy any land at Eden Gardens at all? Because in that general area, if it is a policy had been taken to develop large-scale housing, 200-300 houses in one development, in that part of the country, there's a lot of available land, because there's a lot of unused currently land.
State land.
Yeah, that belongs to the state through one organ or the other. So in fact, why spend any money to buy land from anybody at any price? Because in fact, it was said to me by a member of the cabinet who had served as Minister of Housing at the time, that there was a policy decision taken. I think it was sometime after 03 or 04, it would have been after 04, that in fact no private property was to be purchased in South and Central by HDC, because currently it just been closed and there was all that land available. So it is astonishing, literally astonishing, that a huge purchase like that, which is probably one of their hugest land purchases, could take place in the very area where there's such an abundance of state land, where in fact there had been a cabinet note that should not take place. Apparently the cabinet note must have been rescinded or suspended, I'm not sure what the word is, I'm not learned. But they found a way. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. They found a way to make it happen. And we have spent $175 million for a piece of land we could have bought for $35 million. That in fact, we didn't need to buy any land at all.
Yeah.
It's perfectly ridiculous.
That's crazy. Just listening to that, it is just crazy.
I'll do right now is just open telephone lines at 222-TALK and 612-TALK. That's 8255. All right? Any questions? Feel free to call right now.
And you, just in case you're wondering, we have with us Afro Raymond, and he's talking to us about the Eden Garden scandal. So, I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the action that the government is taking?
Necessary, but not sufficient. It's understandable because the civil lawsuit has a lower burden of proof to win the case than a criminal lawsuit. You see. That's just the way the legal system works. So in fact, in a criminal lawsuit, you have to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt. And in a civil lawsuit, you just prove, you know, in a reasonable balance of probabilities. When I said necessary but not sufficient, so it's good, it's necessary. I commend the people who've taken this action. But it's not sufficient because there's also, from my perspective, been a major fraud on your revenue. Apart from the fraud on your revenue in terms of stealing all that money to buy a piece of land you didn't need to spend all that money for, there's also fraud on your revenue in terms of under declaration for stamp duty, which is a matter between the parties before it came into the hands of the HDC. There's actually learning on the point that it's considered to be a defect in title to have paid too little stamp duty. So in fact, the state shouldn't have been buying that land at all.
All right. But we do have a call. So good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm listening to you. Presenters this morning, I'm very, very, very disturbed about what is happening. But what I also want to say, please don't say anything that when this thing comes up for hearing, it was tried in the public domain already. Please be careful with what you say, because we want to get some outcomes. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Good morning. Ooh, watch your volume.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'm listening to Dr. Munilal and his comment about witch hunting. But this is more than witch hunting, you know. This is real I will agree with the call that came before. We have to be very careful that we do not try it in public.
Yeah. Well, all that we have spoken about thus far, it's in the public domain.
Yes, right? In the public domain. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
I want the callers to understand that this is information that was in the public domain before it became a court case.
Yeah. True.
Right.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yeah. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Afro. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been talking about this one. Whenever I talk about corruption, I always brought this up. I must have mentioned this like 100 times already. And I'm glad some action being taken. But you said there are two things that went on here: the stamp violation, and the price. Now, the stamp violation, could you have like a criminal charge and a civil charge? Because two different things happening, could you have brought two charges?
Yeah. I don't know if you're asking me about double jeopardy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brooke. The issue is a stamp.
Yes.
I consider it a criminal charge.
That is a criminal charge.
And then the other one is a civil charge. So couldn't you...
Well, it's a civil lawsuit.
But it's two different things happened here, so couldn't two charges have been brought there?
That's the point I was making. So that's correct. I was making the point that the civil lawsuit is necessary, but not sufficient, because from what we are seeing at the moment, it doesn't appear that a criminal prosecution has started on the stamp duty. That's what I was saying.
But let me ask this. For a criminal prosecution to take place, would it not require the police to have gotten involved and to do an investigation and then the DPP to instruct on charges?
Well, as far as I'm aware, yes.
Right. And so I think that part of the problem has been, and I mean, up to recently, Dr. Rowley was talking about it in a press conference, is that police investigations here are, in quotation marks, legendary. They take a really long time to happen and for charges to actually be laid. So the state went the route of civil prosecution as opposed to criminal prosecution.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning, Steve, Wendell, Maroda, and Mr. Afro Raymond.
Morning,
really,
ma'am.
Really good program good this morning. Morning. I just happened to turn in late, and I am so glad for the explanation and clarification being given by Mr. Raymond. I'm also wondering, this purchase really is one of many, because there was a property, in Port of Spain also that was bought, and the price for it, and that it was sold to somebody who seemed to be a sympathizer, that was also in question. But this morning, Mr. Raymond, I'm asking, do you have similar fears about the transaction with Tiger Company, fictional or real company called Tiger Company? That's the purchase of, that was a transaction for $5 million, and when they went to check the place registered for the company, it was just an empty lot of land, as well as the Shagaramas leases. Do you agree with the government that they cannot, and Ms. Martin Daly's SC, that it might create complications if they get out of those leases that were signed by the last administration? So if you can comment briefly on those two.
Okay, thanks, caller. I wanted to say, first of all, I can't comment on CDA matters. I'm an advisor to the CDA, so I don't have any comments. Somebody else will have to speak about that. To speak about the Tiger Company, you're talking about a situation with something called Bamboo Investments, which was a litigation brought by Attorney General, as he then was, Anand Ram Logan, against the board directors of ETEC, which was headed by Professor Ken Julian and Wendy Fitzwilliam and other people like that.
Yes.
And there was a situation where indeed there was a company, ETEC, got into a relationship with to make an investment. When it was investigated, because the Ministry of Finance had certain concerns. ETEC is slightly different because it's a private limited company, all the shares of which are held by the state. It's not like HTC. And when there was an investigation by forensic people, and they went to the offices of, I think it's Bamboo, the company was called, or Bamboo Investments or Bamboo Trading, there was nothing there. It was like a piece of land. Just an empty piece of land. So that all came out in the litigation. And what's interesting about that case, because it's a very interesting case in the general realm of corporate governance and the handling of state resources, is that as far as I'm aware, it's the first case has gone to the High Court and the Appeal Court in this country regarding the Section 99, Subsection 1, duties of the company director to be actually exercising best practice and best judgment and to be doing a due diligence before they enter transactions. And I'm not aware that there's any other cases. Of course, they lost in the High Court, they lost in the Court of Appeal, and the persons who are being sued, that is the board led by Professor Ken Julian, have now taken the thing to the Privy Council. So it's going to be fought out there. But it's a very important case because it puts before the court as an important piece of litigation, how do you perform your duties as a state-appointed board of a state enterprise in relation to large-scale transactions. So it's a very important case. So the lady is actually an excellent point. It's not directly related to the HTC thing, but it's an important point, and we need to keep our eye on the what we call the e-tech case.
All right. We do have another call. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you recently...
Good morning.
I went to a piece of land to buy. So I went to a lawyer, and I asked if I did, right? She said, you must get a valuation on the land. I said, why are you getting a valuation on the land? If I come and I tell you the land worth $50,000. She said, that's what you say. I said, so give me the correct reason. You know what she told me? A lot of people undervaluing property to rob the government taxes. And if you're doing that, that's fraud.
Thank you.
If somebody do that, that is a criminal charge.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you.
I raised that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have, in every profession, you have the issue of ethics and good practice, and that could verge into illegality. So, in fact, I agree, a lot of those situations that happen where people could put a figure that's too high or put a figure that's too low for convenience, it is improper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
All right, let's take our final call this morning from Mr. Afra Raymond. Good morning.
Hello? Mr. Raymond.
Yes,
after all is said and done with all the legal maneuvers, is the state going to be able to recover the money?
Thank you.
I mean, the answer is I don't know.
Exactly.
The answer is I don't know. I mean, we have ways that we can track down money. So in the case of the Piako Airport fraud, the that was another complex fraud. And it required a change of government, which is the decisive point that came out in the ETEC case. I'm linking back to the ETEC case. Eh? The decisive point that came out in the ETEC case is that when you have a complex situation taking place, and people who are loyal to a particular political administration do things, you can hardly expect that political administration to take action against what in Trinidad we call their people.
Yeah.
You have to wait for an election to change. It changes from party A to party B. And when party B comes in, they could look at the books and say, well, hang on, this is wrong. And take action. This is the case that Ram Logan made in the lawsuit with Ken Julian and the others with ETEC, that in fact is only when the parties took office that they were able to make the change. And this is why they were able to shift the 4-year rule. There's a 4-year limitation in lawsuits, but they were able to extend the 4-year rule because they had to wait for the change of administration. To come to this gentleman's question, it really was a question of political will and how do you track the money down. In the airport case, the DPP was able to tell us in a press release that $1 billion of our money, because the whole project cost $1.6 billion, $1 billion of our money had been traced going through the global financial system into bank accounts in countries with names we can't pronounce. Countries over here, countries over there, and countries over there that Trinidad has no known links with. But our money ended up there. So it's possible with today's methods to trace that money left this account and that account and so on. And we know the bank account that the company was using, Point Lisa Spark Limited at FCB in Central. We know the bank account they were using. So it's possible to trace it. Whether they've done it, I don't know. Whether they will be successful, I don't know. Whether those are matters, I'm sure it'll be fought over very hard in court.
Yeah.
So I really can't answer you. I hope they do. But that's about all I could say.
So we wait to see the court case. But what you discussed this morning was the preliminary things, mm-hmm. the stuff that you had discovered through your investigation of the Eden Garden project.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
So thanks again.
Thank you
Afra.
So much.
Yep. Thank you so much for being on Power 102 FM this morning.
Thanks very much. And make sure to listen to Power 102 and tune in to AfroRaymond.net.
Mm-hmm. There you go. All the best to you, my friend.